This has been quite a challenging week because I've changed the sermon several times and finally came down with this one. But you should have, if you thought the reading shared by Karen was a challenge, well, the earlier one was even more challenging. That will have to wait till another Sunday. I won't get into it, but I'll give you a clue. It's a scripture from Peter and another from Paul. I want to say there's one from Mary too, but sorry, I can't give you that one. Be that as it may, finally settled into abiding love. So let's go with this one. All right? And you can judge me afterwards. And certainly, it might open up some discussion about the subject of love. So, while the Hebrew and the Christian texts, they relate condemnation and controversy between prophets and kings and priests and carpenters, there are some rather unique readings from the wisdom literature of the Hebrew Bible, which I feel at least are completely non-judgmental and which are, they speak simply of how to live wisely and well and how to treat each other with love and honor and respect. So I'll share a few verses on the subject of Eros, love, from what is known today as the Song of Solomon. We can just call this the Song of King Solomon. How graceful are your feet and sandals, O queenly maiden. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Your navel is a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are pools in Heshbon by the gate of Beth-Rabbin. Your nose is like a tower of Lebanon, overlooking Damascus. Your head crowns you like Carmel, and your flowing locks are like purple. A king is held captive in the tresses. So that's five. I'm going to continue. This is just too good. How fair and pleasant you are, O loved one, delectable maiden. You are stately as a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. I say I will climb the palm tree and lay hold of its branches. Oh, may your breasts be like clusters of the vine, and the scent of your breath like apples, and your kisses like the best wine that goes down smoothly, gliding over lips and teeth. Harvey loved it. What do you think, buddy?
Yes.
Maybe. Should you have covered his ears, or I'm not sure, Dan. Well, but this is a love poem. That's what it is. It's an Eros poem from our Hebrew literature. That's what it is. And it's a poem ascribed to the king of lovers, of King Solomon, the son of King David. And we may assume that Solomon may have acquired his taste for love poetry from his own father, David, who was known as a great poet and a great songwriter, singer of songs. Of course, David was also a warrior, very handsome, created many of our psalms. But the Hebrews, they were wonderful writers, wonderful poets, and they influenced the Greeks. The most ancient Greek love poem in existence, it's this one. Such a longing for love, rolling itself under my heart, poured down much mist over my eyes, filching out of my chest the soft lungs. I just love that poem. I don't know why, but it's the most ancient of Greek poems, and it is written by Archilochos, followed by Aristophanes, who wrote this. Eros lovers are people cut in half. And another Greek poet, Nicharchos, elaborated on this thought, and he said this: if you love me, you hate me. And if you hate me, you love me. Now, if you don't hate me, beloved, don't love me. Did you get that? I'm going to go to... You have to read through this a few times. If you love me, you hate me. And if you hate me, you love me. Now, if you don't hate me, beloved, don't love me. Now, he is struggling here with the strong emotions of love. He's saying that when the lover hates the other, the emotion is directly tied to love. In other words, the words love and hate, they come from the same strong emotional bond to the other. Whereas the words I don't care about you, those words come from emptiness and neglect and apathy. You've heard lovers, marital partners, people in relationships say that. So, I hate you, I hate you. You see, that's coming from love. There's this passion involved in that relationship. Love and hate, they're tied to each other directly. But the apathetic part of it, the neglect, I don't care, that's the one to watch out for. Not caring for the other is really the opposite of love, not hate. Here's the confusion experienced by an early Roman poet named Catullus, and he said, I hate and I love. Why? You might ask. I don't know, but I feel it happening, and I hurt. And the medieval English poet John Donne wrote, let thou thy love and hate and me undo, to let me live, O love, and hate me too. All of this love and hate talk, it speaks of Eros love. And this material I acquired in a book by Ann Carson. It's called Eros, the Bittersweet. She explains that all our desires are contradictory, like the desire for food. I want the person I love to love me. If he is, however, totally devoted to me, he does not exist any longer, and I cease to love him. And as long as he is not totally devoted to me, he does not love me enough. Hunger and repletion are all about life and love. Classical literature defines Eros as a highly spirit-filled sort of love. The Greeks believed Eros held the universe together, and its human form drew from this cosmic ocean of desire. Socrates and his student Plato, I spoke about last week, believed that the world's deepest insights, they have their roots in Eros love. Separatists and Puritans, they had distinct views of Eros, where sex was always suspect because of a depraved world, which is exhibited in Nathaniel Hawthorne's book, The Scarlet Letter. Christian religious teachings have tarnished Eros, often producing shame and guilt and sexual dysfunction. In the last century, Carl Jung has observed people think that Eros is sex, but not at all. Eros is relatedness. Couples who know each other intimately know that sex is not simply a matter of hydraulics. It is a form of communion. In our time, it isn't Eros love at all. It's just plain down-to-earth sex. When I was in the fifth grade, this is in 1963, my friends and I had our secret cave in the valley off the Menominee River Parkway, where we would view, I'm going to get all Jimmy Carter on you right now, so just hold back a little bit. We would view Playboy pictures provided to us by none other than the minister's son. These are cheap thrills, and they were provided by, as it turns out, religion. Today, billboards and books, magazines, movies, cable, and of course the internet, they just do the trick for us. Malcolm Muggeridge said, "People now seem to have sex on their minds," which is a peculiar place to have it. While backpacking through Europe in 1981, Catherine and I recall our time in Amsterdam and Hamburg, Germany, where window prostitutes in the red light district were available to any passerby consumer. Strange how one can shop for sex, similar to shopping for frozen foods and ice cream sandwiches behind glass. What sort of Eros is this? Well, there is a name for it. What do you think that name is? It's lust. The biblical story of lust, it comes from 2 Samuel, and it is David's lust for Bathsheba, the wife of one of his devoted soldiers named Uriah the Hittite. Lust, I'm not going to get too much into that particular story. Karen shared it all. Thank you, Karen. Thank you for correcting me on Joab, too. You're splendid. Joab was David's best friend and watched over him and did whatever he wanted him to do just to make sure that King David would stay in place. Without Joab, David would have been in big trouble. Lust, it destroys marriages, it destroys relationships, and comes in the form of pure violence when connected to any sort of abuse, whether in the family, the profession, or in the community. Lust betrays and demeans and kills the object of its desire. The opposite of lust is fidelity. Lust is related to the word lie because it destroys trust, while fidelity is related to the word truth because it destroys lying. Therefore, Eros is intimacy and trust, and it makes way for faithful relationships. This means that parties in these relationships or friendships between vulnerable, they become vulnerable because trust becomes the foundation. So without trust and fidelity, there is no safe place for the commitments to take root. Rather than tying Eros to lust, it should be linked with trust. Sadly, much of our particular religious tradition has been very successful in separating Eros and trust, spirit and flesh, soul and body, even comparing it to Adam and Eve, male and female. You know the old saying, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. In one of my favorite movies, Moonstruck, a 60-year-old husband who has been having an affair with another woman walks into his home at a late hour, and before he is able to rush upstairs, he's greeted by his wife. His wife is played by Olympia Dukakis. And his wife says to him, just before he gets up the stairs, "You're going to die anyway." Do you remember that scene? Anybody who saw the movie? It's a reminder. No matter how we try to ignore the flesh, from the time we are born, we begin the death march. What can live within this flesh is the spirit, which leads us to abundant life and abiding love. So, how has the church countered all of this lusty, passionate sex. Chastity, chastity. The language of Paul makes this very clear in terms of how sex between spouses must be tolerated only for procreation. This chastity remedy is a legacy from ancient times when Paul and others felt that sex was the opposite of any faithful life. Spirit and flesh, they fight each other. The spirit is light, the body is dark. Discipline and prayer sustain the spirit. Appetites, desire, rot the flesh. The spirit is of the heavens, flesh is of the earth. The sacred, the profane. By living apart from the world, we are saved. Living in the world, we are damned. However, what do we do with words from John's gospel? The word became flesh. Here is the metaphor of God's divinity entering into the human. Spirit and flesh, they provide ballast for each other. Spirit and flesh are not in opposition, but as contrasts, require each other. Now, this brings me to Pentecost and how I ended up with this sermon. Thank you, Rachel, because Rachel reminded me that as an Anglican, or former Anglican, you're a Congregationalist too, you know. The season of Pentecost, it happens to be one of your most beloved of seasons, and today, Pentecost, it begins today. That's why we have these red pyramids. Thank you, Linda. And these beautiful pyramids begin the season of Pentecost. Rachel reminded me, as we were speaking last week, are you speaking about Pentecost? And I said, well, I'm speaking about marriage, love, some of these things. And she said, well, what about Pentecost? And so we changed the middle hymn to bring that in. And that's how I weave into a sermon the Spirit, right? The Spirit. Because it's important for us to look at the Spirit coming down on the apostles and upon all of us, because in the liturgical year, this is the longest part of the year. It goes from red to green. And it's a part of most of the life of the church. So today we celebrate the descent of the Spirit on the apostles and on us, which is to say the odd mixture of body, mind, and spirit. Again, as John's gospel proclaims, the word becomes flesh. For me, this body, mind, spirit thing, it's a challenge. And we will not let others, including religious leaders, do our thinking for us. When we read parables and sayings, we will do our own interpretations with thoughtfulness and let the messages live not only in our minds and spirits and hearts, but in our deeds, in our flesh. The messages of love about the Father, prodigal son, as well as the Samaritan who shared goodness from the heart. These Jesus parables unite spirit and flesh, love and forgiveness, eros and agape. Indeed, Jesus taught and lived a mixture of eros and agape love. This love includes body, mind, and spirit as emanating from one source, God. The flesh is not excluded from the equation, nor is the mind, and of course the spirit is there too. That is why the Eros love poetry shared earlier in the sermon, from the Hebrews to the Greeks to the Romans, all of this, it's equally significant. It's a part of the love equation. Compare Solomon's love poem with the earlier scripture from 2 Samuel about David's affair with Bathsheba. The Eros of Solomon is holy, while the Eros of David is profane. Deceitful lust takes what it wants, oblivious to the consequences, and thus sets death itself into motion. Trusting love is reciprocal and without shame. In fact, the Song of Solomon, it's a metaphor comparing two lovers who long for each other, with God's longing for the redemption of creation, and it does not exclude other people. It embraces them. And Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians that love never ends. He was saying that love abides. Half of all marriages fail with sexual infidelity being the primary cause, and therefore lack of trust in the relationship. It seems to me that only eros and agape, abiding love, can restore faith in those relationships and in all relationships.